Hello and welcome, listeners, to ION EDI, the anti-racism podcast where we unpack equity, diversity, and inclusion. This podcast is recorded on the unceded traditional territory of the Sequimic people. I am grateful for the opportunity to live, learn, and play on their lands.
Hi, Christine. I'm so excited to speak with you today. I haven't actually formally met you before one-on-one, if this has never happened, but I have seen you around in the Indigenous Book Club and the Student Mental Health Forum. So it's so exciting to finally have a conversation together.
I too have been really looking forward to meeting you, seeing you in those various online venues as well, and not actually getting a chance to speak directly back and forth. So this is great.
It is. I have noticed that you engage a lot with platforms that have students integrated into it. I was wondering, like, what value do you see in engaging with students in multiple different spaces?
I feel like I'm always kind of one step behind students trying to catch up to what these various platforms are, for sure. And kind of always wish I was a little bit more current with those things. But it's tough sometimes in certain positions to stay connected with students. The language that's often used is, you know, the higher up, which I am uncomfortable with. But the reality is the career trajectory that moves you into different sorts of positions sometimes means that you spend less time talking one-on-one with students or getting an opportunity to meet with them in group settings. Digital platforms have provided me a little bit of that. And it's also one of the reasons why I'm so excited to be coming back to campus and, like, actually physically running into students on campus and talking to them. I don't think anything can replace actually talking to people in 3D form.
Oh, for sure. And that reminds me of how coming back to campus this year, I think the climate is a little different. We've all been away for a year and a bit. It's been quite a year of reckoning in terms of racial issues, racial trauma, and current events. There's the whole Black Lives Matter movement that started up with higher speed last year, as well as the recent discoveries. And so I was wanting to ask you what it feels like from a leadership perspective coming back on campus and making sure that students coming in feel supported in light of that.
Yeah, it's been quite a year and a half. I at the beginning of 2020, I went on leave actually for 6 months. And so a couple months into that, the pandemic started, and I was already spending a lot of time reading. And then, you know, with the murder of George Floyd, that really started to change what I was reading. I was reading a lot related to decolonization and indigeneity. And then I added into that mix a lot of work by authors who were producing works around anti-racism. I was spending a lot of sort of more contemplative time during my leave. And then that really did stretch into this year of when I came back to work, of actually being sort of at work, but also alone or a little bit more insulated or isolated. And so still continuing to read. So much of what I feel like my experience has been like has been very theoretical or more reading based. And I haven't had as much opportunity in person to talk with folks and to understand more of people, the lived experience of people I know. That said, or people I work with, I guess. So that said, we've had super powerful conversations in my family, particularly since the end of May when the 215 unmarked graves were discovered. I have an interesting family history around residential schools, and it was something that we didn't always talk about. And those conversations around the dinner table with my extended family all of a sudden were more possible and less kind of hypothetical. Like, the reality of those unmarked graves was very, very tangible. I also don't know if those conversations would have happened in the same way if we weren't spending sort of more concentrated time together within our bubbles. It was still kind of like a bubble. So it allowed for a certain type of conversation to happen.
But I do understand your point about having those more meaningful conversations, because I think as traumatic as this last year has been for people, both in terms of the pandemic and racism coming to kind of a boiling point, because I think it's always existed and I've always been conscious of it existing, but I think it's allowed people to have the inability now to ignore it is kind of what I'm thinking, because I speak a lot about how I first encountered racism and what it looked like for me. And it was actually in kindergarten when I went to school, and there was only two dark-skinned kids in the class, and it was me and another boy, and we were picked on by the teacher extra, and I wasn't quite sure what it is until, so I was in Ontario and we went to school when we were four, and until little four-year-old me started picking that apart and was like, oh, I think I've noticed a pattern. It's me and the dark-skinned boy. So it's two dark-skinned kids that get treated differently from all the other little white kids with their pretty blonde eyes and their pretty blue eyes and their little blonde pigtails. That's more appealing to people. And so it would make me feel like maybe I could take a can of paint and paint over the melanin. But a lot of people haven't had that early exposure to racism in such an overt way, or even in just a covert way. And I think this last year has just really provided that opportunity for things to just become unavoidable in a way.
I agree. You know, it's really interesting. It's been an uncomfortable conversation in the past with some of my friends. I've stayed very closely connected to people I've known since I was 10, when I moved to British Columbia. That was a while ago. And we've maintained close friendships, a group of about six of us. And one of us passed away in the last year, and we gathered together a few weeks ago, and we had a conversation we never have had space for before. And it was with one of our friends. We grew up in a very small town, and he is South Asian. And he talked about growing up in our town and the ways in which he and his brother very purposefully set out to fit in, and through athletics, actually, and then through the cars they drove, which was very interesting. It was 80s. I don't know if that was just the thing that they latched onto. Maybe it would be something different now. Maybe it would be around sneaker culture or whatever. I mean, I'm not even saying that should be anything, right? But that conversation and the openness to everyone around the table having that conversation was, it really struck me that a couple of years ago, I don't think we would have talked about privilege in the same way. We wouldn't have talked about racism, like overt racism in a small town.
And I think with that, the aftermath of these realizations is kind of an expectation to move forward in a productive way and to make sure that when we return to campus or when we go back to work, that there are more meaningful changes in place or even just shifts in attitudes, you know?
Yeah, I think that's going to be the big challenge for all of us. Is I think it's easy to sort of rest in some performative statements right now and to not really deal with things that are based in racism, based in conflict. And that's going to take a lot of us aback as we hit campus. Mm-hmm. And we've seen it, I think, to some extent. I'm not sure where you're situated right now.
I'm in Kamloops.
In Kamloops, okay. So we've seen it occurring in other places in British Columbia in terms of anti-Asian racism related to COVID. And I'm not sure what that's going to look like on campus. I mean, I expect it. We've prepared by ensuring that we have additional folks in our student affairs office and other places to help support students and other members of the team. It's something that I'm anxious about, to be quite honest, as a leader, that you're able to keep people safe and keep people well. But sometimes those conversations will be really hard conversations. And so establishing those safe spaces for those conversations to take place.
In your experience, what has it been like convincing? I think there's always a little, some people left over in on the sidelines, still trying to be convinced about the value of certain initiatives or the values of anti-racism work. How do you navigate around that? Because I think, in my experience at least, negative experiences can sit with people longer than positive experiences a lot of times, because I think it's the same around mental health disclosures as well. When you have somebody who responds negatively, it impacts all your other disclosures and how you navigate the world after that. So how have you, in your experience, what has it been like convincing other people and really just getting to a space where there is room for active change making?
I think it's sort of this, I'm trying to get the percentages right. I mean, you could go 10, 80, 10, or you could go 20, 60, 20. Like, there's the people who are there and they're, you know, anxious for change making. They're ahead of me for sure in their thinking. They're, you know, obviously they don't require the same sort of engagement. They're engaged. And there's, on the other end of the spectrum, there are people who aren't ready or refuse to even prepare to be ready. And then there's a group in the middle who are wanting to learn and scared. I think to learn, like, it's scary for me to really reflect on the ways in which I walk into a room and what I carry with me in terms of privilege as a white cisgendered woman who, you know, is heterosexual and, you know, sort of raised in upper middle class situations. So I feel fairly comfortable engaging in those conversations, and I can see in the eyes of other folk who want to engage in those conversations but are a little scared and need some safe spaces to do it. And I'd rather spend my energy working with others and thinking about that than really trying to push against the other 10 or 20% who are, you know, heels dug in. And it's I don't want to ignore that they're there, because I think they harm others, and that's important to acknowledge. But I don't want to lose the opportunity to be engaged with others who are perhaps part of a bit of a groundswell, or maybe not. I mean, you kind of hope it is, but I like that you compare it with mental health, Emma, because I've been fairly open about my own life, in which I've, in the last few years, diagnoses of depression and anxiety, and I try to disclose that as I can. It's been a very interesting sort of process for me to think about, like, what was the threshold for me to actually start talking about it with people, and the importance of doing that. And always in the back of my mind is, I'm sure there are people who go, buckle up, you know, don't be a snowflake, you know, that sort of thing. I'd much rather engage in the conversation with people who are really starting to struggle with their mental health, and recognizing that if they raise their hand or they seek help, that there's someone there who they can talk to, or there's resources out there, than spend my time trying to convince someone that I really am not doing well right now.
Yeah, we've been talking a lot about, in the past year that I've been working as a storyteller and now in my current position about student storytelling, now in my current position about how mental health and anti-racism work are kind of just very intertwined. And they're very, very similar, because ultimately your ability to thrive at university is impacted by your mental health. And for students that are visible minorities, that their mental health is impacted by a multitude of unique factors. So for example, for immigrants, for children of immigrants like me, failure isn't an option, because if I fail at university, what am I going to do with myself? The world already has such a negative view of me very easily, in general, in very broad terms, that if I'm not something, the world isn't a hospitable place for me. So failure often isn't an option, because you're letting down so many people that have their hopes tied to you. Mm-hmm. And very recently, I read a tweet, I think, by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in the United States. I'm a big fan of hers. She replied to someone and said that you have no idea the pressures and the experiences of firstborn, first generation daughters, especially, and all the hopes and everything tied to them, and the way they carry their parents, especially since a lot of our parents, we don't know that system, right? Like, my parents didn't do their undergrad in Canada. I was the first one to transition from high school to undergrad. So all those things kind of weigh on you a lot differently, and it impacts your mental health. And so I've been really interested in figuring out ways that as a community, as a university, we can support students that are visible minorities in their mental health.
Yeah, and I think where we have work to do is that a lot of the supports that one would reach out to at TRU and perhaps at other institutions, they don't have people in those supports, offering those supports, who look like or have lived experiences similar to students who come from racially marginalized backgrounds. And I'm trying to find ways for us to recruit and hire more people. And that's hard too, because there's a lot of demand for folks as well. And so you have to, make it really attractive for folks to move to Kamloops or to stay in Kamloops and not go elsewhere. So I want to be sure that students can see themselves in the resources that are available. The experience of not being able to fail is something that isn't part of my experience at all. And I want to learn more about that. Listening to you talk about that is really interesting for me. I think I came from a family where it was, you learn by making mistakes and you pull yourself back up again and you make more mistakes and, reflect on that and what did you learn from it. And it's a big blind spot for me when I hear you talk about that experience. And I suspect it's, you represent it as being broader than just your own family circumstances, others.
Well, for sure. And I think it's a misconception on instructor sides and in just in society in general, on the stereotypes of, oh, Asians are smarter or certain people are more hardworking. And a lot of times it is that fact that failure isn't an option. So in high school, we often spent our summers doing math and science while other kids were off playing soccer and going on hikes and adventures. And I was really honestly at some point resentful of that I had to sit and I had to put this extra work in, until I realized that the world doesn't have room for me if I'm not an accomplished person. I have to be somebody to be taken seriously. And that really weighs on students from visible minorities in university as well, because you constantly have that pressure to outperform others. Otherwise, you're just another brown kid or another black kid, or you need to be better than somebody else to be of value. And that's incredibly stressful. And I'm very lucky to have my mom as a huge support system, and then have people on campus that I know well who are able to, you know, support and direct and understand. Especially, I'm so privileged to have this position, but a lot of students don't. And that pressure to outperform others or be better is enormous, and which is why I say that racism is really a healthcare issue, because until you're healthy and whole, you can't perform better, and you can't perform at any level at all.
Tell me, did you find it tempting during online learning to not be visible in the same way? Did that come into play?
I don't have that option because my name, right? My name is visibly different, so I don't have that option at all. Which is another thing that I've noticed, is that students on campus will anglicize their names, so they're not automatically, you know, seen as a visible minority, which is a little heartbreaking to me, because our names have value. And the way I was named my name for a reason, because my mom valued peace and what my name represented, because my name literally translates to peace and what that brings to the world. And a lot of names are chosen for that reason in other cultures, for the value that they bring. So that's a little heartbreaking to me too.
I hate seeing students change their names. I started my career as an ESL teacher back in Ottawa, and we had all these students who came with names like Patience or Peace or, you know, Chastity. There were great names from students whose teachers in high school had given them a book of virtues, I think, and you know, asked them to pick one. And I always found that that was just so unfortunate and lazy on the part of the teachers, right? Because, I mean, we learn how to say all sorts of other things. We can learn how to say someone's name, because I really do believe people's names are just, they are precious. I mean, mine is one aunt's name is my first name, and one aunt's name is my middle name. And that has meaning to me. It would make me feel horrible if I went somewhere else and had to be called something different. But we also know all those studies, right, where people's names are removed or changed, and what that means to how they're viewed as applicants. And so while I despairing of it, I also sympathetic's the wrong word. I mean, it proves the system, right? It proves systemic racism that names come into play in that way.
Well, for sure. You're absolutely right. And I kind of want to go back. Sorry, you excited me a little. I want to go back to one of your previous points about growing up with a friend of yours who felt the need to like fit in more and do things that would make him seem more white. And that's something I've noticed on campus, actually, is that a lot of times we all talk about diversity and how diversity is important. It's great. It's great. It's great. But then everybody feels pressured to fit into that mold of upper middle class white people and look like that. And so I think that has an impact on the way people perceive you. And I think you can't really have that diversity if people are still feeling pressured to change who they are to fit in.
Yeah, you know, I read this, I took a course this past few months on women in academic leadership, and one of the readings was on the imposter syndrome. And I think what you're talking a bit about is the imposter syndrome. And, you know, I often feel it, like, oh, play along until you get along, or fake it till you make it, that sort of thing, right? But what that is really about all sorts of structural inequities, that you feel like an imposter because there is this notion of who folks should be. And so you act in ways that aren't true to yourself or true to your heritage, or true to your values, or whatever. And yeah, I see that. Like, and I hear interesting arguments, Amna. I hear folks say, well, if I was living in India, I'd like to know about all the different festivals, and I'd like to participate in that and, you know, learn more about the clothing and all of that. When I say, do you really think we should have Christmas decorations up? Like, is that is that appropriate? Because it doesn't relate. Well, you know, if I were an international student in another country, I'd like to do that. It's not always international students, as you yourself know, right? It's, you know, it's about people feeling that the spaces they're in resonate with them and reflect who they are. I don't know where I went with that answer, but the imposter thing is really interesting to me, because it's not like you're an imposter of being someone who, you know, you feel like you should be racially marginalized, or you feel like you should live with a disability. It's that you feel like you should be this, you know, someone who appears on kind of the board of directors page of an annual report that looks all very stale and pale and male. But,
oh no. You know what, it's, I like that you said male, because I've noticed huge similarities between feminism and anti-racism work. It's really very similar, because in both cases, for women to seem like, you see these tips, I'm not sure if you've come across them, you probably have, but of how to seem more assertive at work, or how to be more like, how to get into the boys club at work, like how do you adjust yourself? And a lot of that time, it's like you're having to chip away at parts of yourself to seem like you can get in with the club. And it kind of makes me think of Hillary's pantsuit, and how if there wasn't that expectation to seem more masculine in the heterosexual sense, would she be wearing a pantsuit? You know, and why does everybody talk about her pantsuit? You know, this is the whole idea of just, you have to seem like a strong man to be in a leadership position.
Yeah, when I was in my 20s, Kim Campbell was running, well, wasn't running for prime minister. She was a prime minister for a short period of time. And then there was an election. She didn't win the election. But that was like the first time I saw a woman leader really being criticized for what she looked like, how she spoke, all of those sorts of things. And certainly I experienced that a lot. And I remember someone once telling me that you have to be really careful being assertive as a woman, because you will look angry. And you will, you know, and that, and again, that was in like my mid to late 20s, and just being kind of shocked about that, that it'll be seen as aggression. It'll be seen as not what everyone expects. And certainly I'm familiar with people saying, you know, that I can be shrill, you know, those sorts of things. But I also know that my experience as a woman, as a white woman in those settings, has got to be very dissimilar from women of color in those situations, where there are expectations around, say, how submissive an Asian woman should act in a particular setting, or that Black women look angry when there is, you know, I don't have that additional intersectionality. And I always want to be careful that when I characterize my experience as a woman in those settings that are full of dudes, that it's very different from what other women who are not white maybe experience. Mm-hmm.
It is different in terms of that people are convinced that I'm oppressed, regardless of how many times I'm telling you that no, but it's like, you know, like listen to the actual person talking to you. And I think that's the danger of that single story, which is what we're trying to do with this podcast, is have more than one story at all times. And when people see like one face of something, that's the only face they see. They don't see the other side, which is what they really need to see and understand, that feminism looks different around the world. It can be different for, like, for me, empowerment doesn't necessarily mean dressing more provocatively. That means, you know, dressing more modestly. And for me, that means that the focus is no longer on how I look, it's on how I perform and my brain and my value to the world. Whereas for someone else, it might be more liberating to wear less clothes. And it's just understanding those different perspectives that people have, which I think intersects really beautifully with anti-racism work and building off people's, you know, that empathy that people have inside themselves and the ability to see yourself reflected in a similar situation, which is why I use mental health and feminism as a nice comparative to how racism feels to people.
That's really interesting. I have an extra sister in my life, and she's a woman of color. And she said to me one day, Chris, the fact that I'm Black should be the first thing people see when they meet me, and it should be the last thing they see when they leave me. That they understand that my experience in the world is different. But when we leave each other, there are the things that we share or that we have connected about, that we've learned more about each other. I may not be wording it quite the way she did. She's way better with words than I am.
You're absolutely right in terms of the way you worded it, because I think the same can be said of students, and especially visible students from diverse backgrounds, visible minorities, because I like to think of myself as a little wordsmith. And I was thinking the other day, and the thought I had was that I have a very hard time helping my goldfish stay alive. It never quite works out. I've tried. I'm very bad at fish raising, but it made me think of how goldfish, and of course not in terms of death, but goldfish and students from, you know, visible minorities are kind of in the similar boat. Because you can't just put a goldfish into a tank and expect it to thrive, right? And it's the same with students. Nothing's happening to the students, though. Not like the end is not what happened to the goldfish, but kind of similar in that you can't put me into a space and expect me to do well without providing me with that support, knowing that I'm a Muslim woman in Canada with dark skin, trying to survive and trying to overcome these barriers. So I think there's the part about making sure that there is, when we talk about diversity, it's not just diversity, because diversity alone can't solve anything. There needs to be like active work to support people, you know?
Yeah, you know, so much of the work in student affairs in the past was about like, what are first year students experiencing? And I worked a lot in first year experience type of programming about 20 years ago. And you know, so we tried to kind of come up with the archetypal first year student. And I think where we've got to recently has been better, where we're recognizing that what we called non-traditional students before are now, in some cases, referred to as the new majority students. And, you know, and when we start to think about the new majority students, it's students of color, students with different religious backgrounds, students who are transitioning potentially, students with disabilities, students with parenting responsibilities or with elder care responsibilities. Mm-hmm. Like, we start to think, wow, the majority of our students, maybe perhaps all of them, are not 18-year-old white kids who have, you know, finished with a 90% average in high school and, you know, want to be engaged in sports and need drinking, you know, safe drinking messages, but that there's a whole bunch of other experiences in there. It's made our work harder. I don't think it's made it better yet. I think we're just on the cusp of making it better, because we're starting to acknowledge that our programming doesn't reach everybody, doesn't resonate with everybody. And, you know, the imagery we use, the time of day that we use, the mode that we use, like, I think COVID, that's the big learning.
Yeah.
COVID, that, you know, we have, our no-show rate in counseling has plummeted during COVID, because students don't have to find a way to get to campus on a day they don't have classes to have a counseling appointment, and they can have their kid playing beside them while they meet with a counselor or whatever. We've really realized, we've seen into students' lives, I think, in different ways.
It's made people that are a little bit nosy like me have a field day looking into people's background.
Yeah, no, those are lovely purple grapes behind you. It's just my boring office.
No, I think it's like, but you are right. Aside from my nosiness aside, it is pretty interesting to see people's lives in a different way. And I'm interested to hear about that archetype of the students. So what kind of work goes into creating that? And is that something that you're still kind of working on, in creating new archetypes of potential students?
We haven't done that for a while. So I think that that was something that was sort of the typical first year student experience that was done through setting up first year seminars in the past, these sorts of things that were quite popular, like I say, about 20 years ago. About 8 years ago, we did that a bit in student development in terms of trying to have a sense of what types of messages are best to communicate when. So we didn't talk about how to communicate those messages, but the life cycle of a student, and I think some of the folks you work with may be familiar with some of the documents that we have around that. Like, we know that before students get midterm results, they don't necessarily have an answer for parents who ask how they're doing in their classes. Or they don't have parents who are, or family members, because it may not be parents, it might be sisters or brothers or aunties or kids who've been to university before and don't recognize that you don't get grades until sometimes the end of October, sometimes the middle of November, right? So you don't actually know how you're doing. So we talked about that sort of stage being something that we need to consider around communication. We know that money tends to run really thin in February, so those sorts of things that maybe cross across a large swath of students, but not necessarily all. And there can be some useful ways of dealing with some generalities, because it helps you to plan some of the things you want to provide for students at the right time, but you still can't work on the assumption that everyone's going through the same thing at the same time.
You know what? I find that a little bit interesting, actually. I know it's a bit of an outdated way, but if I was to say, me in all my glory was to come up to you and tell you everything that was a problem for me in first year and all the considerations that went into it because of my background, I think that actually might help with designing a better experience for first year. And I've just had an idea of how, if we want to, and I know you're engaged in this a lot, if you want to help students, you have to listen to them. And that's kind of a great way if you can, listen to students and figure out what makes their experience different and what their unique needs are. And then you can kind of reverse work on that, which I think isn't quite always how we do things in institutions, where it's mostly people working and then the population responds.
Well, we tend to take the easiest path all the time, right? Water does that, moving down a hill too. And, we do tend to take the easiest path. We also tend to draw on our own experience. And until the composition of student affairs changes over time, we'll always be, it has the potential to be less inquisitive about what students who aren't like me are experiencing. Last spring, when I was still on leave, I was doing some Instagram lives with student affairs folks from around. Look at me being the cool kid, right? But with folks who work in student affairs across Canada, and I was talking to my friend Jen Gonzalez, who's the executive director of student affairs at Ryerson University. And I was saying to her, I said, I'm always thinking about, like, what would Chris Gunn want when she was 18 I was at the University of Ottawa in first year. What could have made my year better? And she looked at me as a woman of color and said, what would be a better question right now is what would get Jen Gonzalez. That, it's what you needed then probably looked like what all the other students around you looked like. And students, the student body is much more diverse than it was in 1986. And I was really pulled back by that and thought, okay, so I don't have my own experience to draw on. And so I do need to listen to students. Those voices that you're talking about, like listening to you and what do you need and what was your year like? That's important.
I've been thinking a lot in the terms of last year and how people have responded to news and different events that have taken place in the world. And I know that for me, it's doubly traumatic to see the news and then to be expected to be the spokesperson or the apologist for all brown people or all melanated people or all Muslim people in the world. And I've noticed in particularly in classrooms that it's really strong because somebody will read out the news or the instructor will acknowledge the event. And suddenly I feel like I'm placed in front of a jury and people are deciding if I'm a good brown person or a bad brown person, if I'm a good Muslim or if I'm one of the dangerous Muslims, you know? And it's really stressful. And so it made me think about going back to campus in terms of anti-Asian hate when people, when people start being in more close proximity, it's a genuine fear that I'm sure everybody has about the potential for more overt racism or in terms of responses to the Black Lives Matter protests or the recent discoveries of unmarked graves. I say discoveries in terms of news disclosure, of course, not undermining the fact that Indigenous communities, you know, had more knowledge about this beforehand. But just in terms of just how do you navigate response to students in these times, because I've noticed emails from the university and those feel reassuring to me, but also I know that there is the potential for that harmful alienation within classrooms. So it's, I think what I'm trying to ask you is how do you balance the education for instructors on how to respond, and then how do you respond as an institution, as a faculty?
I don't know. I really don't. It's something that I think we need to learn more about, because I myself worry about not wanting to call on someone and put them in that position of speaking for others. But I also never want to ignore that someone's in the room who may be impacted by this or hasn't been and feels badly that they haven't been or that they didn't know about or this isn't a conversation in their family because their circumstances are different. And just because they're, you know, this color doesn't mean that they had that same experience. So back to your question, like, I don't know. And I don't know what you would say to that. What does it feel like to have folks talk about Muslim women in a class without acknowledging that you're there? Or do they always acknowledge that you're there?
I think the only time that it's acknowledged is when it's negative, which is the problem with the single story problem, right? It's that I'm only acknowledged as someone with more unique needs or someone worthy of having a voice when I'm required to apologize for all the Muslims in the world. That's really the only time that my voice is as valuable to people. And then that indicates like a whole nother backlash, because that's really stressful. And I think that's something that I try to avoid. I hide. And it's like, I don't want to do that because it's a lot of emotional burden, because although I know what I'm all about and what people like me are all about, people have a distorted view of it because of many years of, in all honesty, propaganda. Because you need to make the effort to hate people and to convince people to hate people, you have to put in a lot of dehumanization. And it's that rehumanization that I'm trying to do with things like this podcast, of understanding that, you know, just because someone looks different to you or just because you've been fed this narrative doesn't mean that that's who they are. So rehumanizing with people. And in terms of, I think, instructor responses, like I was saying, I think it's helpful when instructors acknowledge events without demonizing people. I know that, but at the same time, it's kind of strange because it's the kind of events that are acknowledged. Like, are you acknowledging tragedies that happen to people of color, or are you only acknowledging tragedies that happen in Western nations? You know, it's that balance of figuring things out, because a lot of times in the news, I'll hear something and I'll go, oh, I think maybe, because I listen to a lot of news in a lot of different languages. I've been blessed to have that ability to speak quite a few languages, and so I can listen to the news and have different perspectives. And a lot of times I wonder, oh, I think that'll be addressed in CBC, or that'll be addressed in CNN, and it never is. And because of that, it changes the narratives that people have of suffering, and it makes certain people seem like the people who are always making others suffer, but their tragedies aren't as valuable, or there's no value associated with that. So it's kind of like, what are you acknowledging, and what do you think is relevant to the classroom? And then also, even if you are, say, we're in a classroom right now, and I'm the instructor, and I've just read out the news about something and said that this is what's happened. I understand that the classroom might have a variety of responses. If anyone has anything they'd like to say, please do so in a constructive manner and be respectful of everybody without looking directly at that one melanated person, you know, because that's the problem, because the words will be right, but the body language is just focusing in on me. And it's like, that didn't help either, because you just basically invited me to speak without saying so, you know? Mm-hmm.
Do instructors ever call you into that conversation in a less public space? Like, is there a reach out to you?
No.
To say, hey, you know, this happened, and how are you doing? You know, is it something that you're comfortable with talking about in class? Would you like me to acknowledge it? Like, I wonder about that type of approach.
Actually, no, that's never happened. And it's again, one of the guests that we have coming on is Jen May, and she talks about mental health disclosures and her thesis about the differences that students of visible, like minorities, students of color, and their disclosures and the response that they expect. So I never expect a white person to care about me or anybody like me. It's a defense mechanism. It's that if I don't have that expectation, I'm not going to be disappointed. And that's the difference between me and the average stereotypical university student who would expect a positive response. Because a lot of times I've noticed, even when people are trying to be nice, there's that undertone of distrust that just really gets at me, you know? And it's that you're trying to acknowledge me as a person, but you're at the same time, you're subtly accusing me. And it's trying to, and because of that, you kind of become hypervigilant of everything. And everything that you do in your daily life is hyper aware of everything, which I think is a trauma response. And I think that's one of the things that people don't realize about students of color, is that we're always hyper-vigilant, because not all the responses that we've had from people are positive.
I'm sorry to hear that. I think I often think about the, you know, the tragedy that happened when the Humboldt hockey team was in that accident, and how quickly people put out put on green and yellow jerseys and, you know, ribbons and everything relative to the shootings in the Quebec mosque, or, you know, and that I hadn't really thought of it in terms of the hypervigilance that you've just described, and that when an event like that happens, there's a different sort of, well, there isn't support, is what I'm hearing from you, for however your reaction is to that experience.
Yeah, and that I think that hypervigilance transfers to all aspects of life, because I'm very visibly different looking. You know, it's really hard to miss me in a crowd. And because of that, for people who do hold negative views of me, they're very easily able to find me and express those views completely unsolicited, you know? So I think there's that unavoidable lens of, if you're a Black woman, or if you're a Black person in general, if you're South Asian, if you're any kind of visible minority person of color, you're automatically more visible and thus exposed to potential danger. And I think we need to bring value to, not value, but bring attention to the fact that it's not just overt racism that chips away at people. It can be microaggressions. And I kid you not, microaggressions, I think, are the worst forms of racism, because you can never tell people about them, because the likelihood of somebody believing them is really low. So if I told you about, I think you, because you engage with students so much and you engage on this topic so much, you may be able to understand this as a problem, but someone else may not. So when I was starting up nursing school, I had somebody, you know how people have conversations with just strangers in waiting rooms? Somebody asked me what I was studying, and I told them I was in nursing school, and they responded with the fact that, oh, so you're becoming an LPN. And I said, no, I'm becoming an RN. She's like, oh, well, you can't become an RN. It's like, I can't become an RN? Why not? I just told you I'm in an RN program. She's like, because that you don't meet the requirements. And I was like, the requirements? Okay. And so the whole conversation was about them convincing me that I couldn't be in an RN program. And then similarly, a few days ago, actually, this is a little funny. It was that I was buying a bag for clinicals. It was a larger bag to fit my stethoscope, my shoes, everything. And the person at the till said, that's a nice color. And I said, thanks. I'm really excited. I hope it'll fit all my things this time, which is a normal statement to make. And the person responded with, yeah, the first time my sister saw a purse, she also stuffed a lot of things into it, not realizing how many things she had to carry. And I was like, wait a minute, it's not the first time I saw a purse. But like, it left a really sour taste in my mouth. And I wasn't sure why the assumption was that I would never have seen something like a purse before. But it's those little things, like, so I can't justify them to somebody as saying, oh, that left a sour taste in my mouth. Thus, I feel like I have been attacked in a racist manner, which is what I think student supports and student services need to, or people in positions of power need to understand, that the microaggressions really, really chip away at people's sense of identity and your ability to just exist as a whole human.
Yeah, which fits into what you were talking about hypervigilance as well. You always think those microaggressions are potential in any interaction. Hey?
Have I seen a purse before, Chris Adams?
I'm expecting so.
Sorry, I like to laugh about these things, because if I don't laugh, they pile up on you.
Yeah, but I suppose the response, if you point that out, is, you know, it was meant as a joke. That's not what I meant. That's not what I meant. Like you say, they chip away. And I wonder how we better educate people about the impacts of their words in things that they think are just minor interactions. Like how we help people see I'm guilty of it too. I mean, I'm talking about myself, how we see how the little throwaway phrases, the things that we think are throwaway phrases, actually really reify a structure of inequity and aren't throwaway to the person receiving them, that they are, like you say, they're compounding.
Mm-hmm. For sure. And I think, you know, the first steps, in all honesty, are things like this, are having those real conversations and telling both stories and engaging with real people and, you know, just making that effort to read a book about, say, maybe this weekend I won't read a novel. I won't reread Pride and Prejudice for the 200th time. I am guilty of that. I've memorized the whole book, if you can believe it. And instead I'll read maybe How to Be an Anti-Racist. That's from the Intercultural Resource Guide, in case and nobody listening to this has checked that out. You should definitely do so. But it's just like taking that step to be uncomfortable for a minute, you know?
Yeah. It may be also encouraging folks, if a book is kind of an intimidating thing to start in the middle of studies and everything, to follow different people on Instagram or follow different people on Twitter and listen to different podcasts. Actually, the podcast that I really am enjoying right now is
ours.
Yours. Our podcast. It's Good Ancestor. And now, right now, I'm going to completely forget the name of the person who hosts it. Ah, it's going to kill me. But it's such a good podcast that I normally wouldn't listen to, because as Alicia knows, I tend to listen to like these gossipy kind of, you know,
oh, I like those.
Even the rich and you know, these kind of ones, but that one pushes me more, and it's going to drive me crazy that I can't think of her name, but lots of different perspectives. And if your feeds are full of people who look like you and sound like you, you're in a silo, and that's a really receptive activity, right? Like you can listen to others' voices and sort of take them in and reflect on them. Perhaps the next step is to sort of move forward and amplify them and share them with others. But even better is like being in person and talking and, you know, eating a meal together. I think Trusu's beginning this breaking bread, or they're continuing their breaking bread series, where they bring in people with, you know, from different walks of life, from all sorts of different professions as well and stuff, and engage in a meal together. There's something about that I think it just provides a different sort of openness to understanding each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it reminds us that we're all human, and yeah, the rehumanization piece that we talked about earlier.
Yeah, I like that expression, rehumanization.
Thank you so much for taking time to speak with us today. I do really appreciate it. And I'm excited to see you around more in person, hopefully, finally, on campus soon.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it too. Thank you for understanding my learningness in all of this too. I think we all have lots to learn. I certainly do, about how to do better and be better. So thanks for engaging me in this conversation. We'll break bread together sometime soon.
Hopefully soon. Thanks so much. I hope you have a lovely time returning to campus.
You can find more information about this podcast, past episodes, and mental health supports on the website i-on-edi.truebox.ca.